posed to our two speakers are to ask them each in turn to state in a few words, which is difficult for both of them, what are the basic features of their respective beliefs. And I'll ask Professor Elton if he would like to kick off.
Well, thank you very much, Malcolm. I would like to say that whatever I say this evening, at the very most, expresses my own beliefs. It certainly doesn't express anybody else's. I do not stand for anybody except myself. I also said at the very most, because I'm quite liable to change my mind. I must just disclaim some of the more extravagant association that our chairman, not Malcolm, Angus, put me to. My attachments to the various parts of the Christian faith were in fact ones that came to me one way or another, but none of them through belief. In other words, I was rather much more in the situation of the person in Omar Khayyam who searched about it and about. And eventually I found, possibly through my views as a scientist, I don't know, that I found most satisfaction in just steering clear for quite a long while from these kind of discussions, these kind of thoughts. And for quite a long time, I gave them very little concern indeed. And out of this grew a conviction that in some sense, and I don't want to make this sound in any way presumptuous, man himself was something that man at his best could be quite proud of, and that a belief in the importance and dignity of the individual was something that to me came to be uppermost, and that I came to conclude that to guide one's life on that belief was satisfying and adequate. I think I would like to leave you at that point.
Paulson. I'm somewhat embarrassed to discover that I'm the only one of the three out here without his Bible. And I could begin by saying that as a Christian, I believe all that there is. Thank you. As a Christian, I believe all that there is in that book, but since I haven't got my Bible, let me try and just list a few of the basic beliefs, though it would need a couple of hours to list them all. I believe that this universe happened by choice and not by chance, and that behind it and before it ever was a personal reality to whom I give the name God. And that this God was not just one person, but more than one person, so that I also believe that love, relationship between persons, is an even greater and prior reality to the universe in which I live. That when this universe began to be, it was made by that personal reality. And that when men were made, again they were not the result of chance, but of choice. And that alone among all the creatures and all the parts of our universe, human beings were made with the capacity of knowing the reality behind the universe in terms of personal relationship and discovering the love that there was in that person. I believe, next, that that personal God visited this planet in the form of a human being 2,000 years ago. That one of the three persons who together make up the personal reality I know as God came and lived my life here with the express purpose of restoring a broken relationship between human beings and their divine creator. I think that sums up the basics, so we'll keep it brief.
Yes, congratulations. Now, perhaps I could come back to you first, David, and say, would you like to take on one particular aspect which is implied in what you have said already, and give your views on the nature of man himself?
If you'll forgive a bit of alliteration, there are three things that I believe as a Christian about human beings. And the three headings, if you like, would be the dignity, the depravity, and the destiny of human beings. And at these three points, I find that Christians have a unique understanding of men. As far as the dignity of man goes, I've said it already, that he is not a developed animal, but a unique combination of the physical part of the universe and something else which makes him akin to God. In other words, alone in the universe, man has an origin that is quite different from the origin of everything and everyone else. That's his dignity. His depravity is quite simply that something has gone terribly wrong with the human race that makes us quite incapable of creating for our children the conditions that we'd wish, and of solving the deepest problems with which this world of ours is beset. So that our depravity is that we have lost something that we were meant to have. And our destiny is something beyond this world altogether. I've got a collie dog which I was exercising just before this meeting. I don't believe that my dog has any destiny beyond this world. Fond though I am of her, she hasn't that destiny. But I believe that human beings have a destiny right outside and beyond this universe altogether. And that that destiny depends very much on this life, what we do in it, and above all, our relationship to God.
Thank you. Lewis, would you care to comment?
Well, I'd like to read to you from Tillich, The Shaking of the Foundations, not a humanist. When we look at the misery of our world, its evil and its sin, especially in these days which seem to mark the end of a world period, we long for divine interference so that the world and its demonic rulers might be overcome. We long for a king of peace within history, or for a king of glory above history. We long for a Christ of power. Yet, if he were to come and transform us and our world, we should have to pay the one price which we could not pay. We would have to lose our freedom, our humanity, and our spiritual dignity. Perhaps we should be happier, but we should also be lower beings. Our present misery, struggle, and despair notwithstanding, we should be more like blessed animals than men made in the image of God. I find it very difficult, in fact impossible, to improve on that as a statement of my humanist belief in man.
Well now, I think one more question, and then we will see whether this presents a clear picture to everyone. It flows, I think, out of the last one again, and perhaps, Lewis, you might like to answer it first. What, in your view, is the purpose, then, of this life?
One of the difficulties in conducting a discussion of this nature, and I'm not going to call it debate because I think we are already moving in the right direction for this evening in that we are not talking against each other but trying to move things forward. But one of the difficulties in such a discussion is that one at times is asked a question to which one doesn't believe there is an answer. In other words, it is not that one doesn't know the answer, it is that one believes that it's the wrong question. I mean, obviously,
Obviously, there are some silly questions which have no meaning, like, why does a mouse when it spins? There are others which one feels that whatever one says, one is bound to say the wrong thing, like, have you stopped beating your wife? Now, I've used these two rather trivial examples because at that level everybody accepts it. What I would like to suggest is that at our deepest spiritual level too, there are questions the meaning of which may simply not be apparent, or may be, in some people's opinion, non-existent. Now, in particular, this can arise when we are transferring everyday experience to a region of which we have no experience whatsoever. Now, to ask me what I think is my personal destiny for the next 10 years, in other words, what are my ambitions, what are my hopes, my fears, what do I wish to be, and so on, is a very sensible question, which I am not prepared to answer tonight. In other words, we each feel that within our own lives we have some kind of a destiny. But to go from that and to say that mankind as a whole has a destiny may be extrapolating that particular word, destiny, and the idea of a thing, a being, a group having a destiny beyond, wildly beyond, anything that we have experience of. Even the destiny of a people in history is something that is a highly problematic concept. There have been times when it was stated that it was the destiny of the people so-and-so to conquer the world. It was the destiny of the Swedes at one stage, of the French at another, of the Germans at another. Turned out to be the destiny of none of them. And it's very doubtful whether it was meaningful to speak of it like that. So I am not going to answer that question. To me, I'm sorry, it has no meaning.
David? Well, if the universe were the result of chance, and if man were the result of evolutionary chance, then this question is a meaningless question, because there could be no purpose in something that happened by chance. But since, as a Christian, I believe both the universe and men were by choice, there must have been some reason behind the action which led to both coming into being. And the reason, the purpose of life as a whole, rather than my individual life, but my individual life finds its purpose in the larger purpose, I understand to be summed up in one word, love. But by that, I don't mean either a sexual or a sentimental relationship between people. I mean something very much bigger, and I mean primarily that this life is the opportunity for men and women to get to know God and learn to love Him. And then in the light of that, to learn properly to love each other. I take that as the purpose of life. That's what I think it's all about. And I think most of the pop songs today would agree with me, except that I think I have found out where it really does exist.
Well, I think at that point we take a break, as they say in some programs, a break for you to come in, please, with very direct questions on anything you would like either or both speakers to clarify.
I'd like to ask Professor Elton why he doesn't just simply answer the question about destiny by saying none. Why do you say that there is no question, or the question has no meaning? Why not, in the context of the way the question is asked, say, in your opinion, if this is what you believe, there is no purpose, there is no destiny?
No, I don't think that is right, because that implies, of course, but the question to me has a meaning, and I can say yes or no. This might well be the position of a convinced atheist, which I'm not, because an atheist is as much a believer as a theist. I do quite genuinely mean that we are in the middle of the way of life for all of us, individuals, peoples, so on. That comes from Dante in Mezzo del Cammino. So consequently, we don't simply know what history will bring. And if I'm asked what is my own personal feeling about this within my own lifetime, then that's a very different question. And to that extent, I am not in disagreement that to increase the sum total of love in this world and to decrease the sum total of evil, I would certainly consider to be a destiny to be aimed at, but I would not say that it is built in to the situation as it is.
Professor Alton mentioned that he believed that man is something that man himself could be proud of. But in the extract from Cynic, the gist seemed to be that although we have freedom, which we may possess, but that we couldn't preserve our dignity if in fact anything was done to remedy this mess. Are we then saying that a misused freedom is something that we can be proud of?
No. I hope not. No. If the remedy comes from outside, then we have failed ourselves. The remedy must come from inside our individual selves, and then we can be proud of it. That, I think, is a rather feeble paraphrase of Tilling.
Would the Reverend Boston please say how he stands on the question of evolution? If man is now has a destiny special and different from a dog or an afterlife special and different, would he tell us whether this was always so, whether if he does, if he is the evolution of a dog or method, man has evolved, if he did evolve, what point did he get the special destiny and how?
Knowing that Mr. Pawson has a 90-minute tape or so on this,
yes, I think most people present do know my views on this. In a sentence, it seems to me that on the balance of the scientific evidence, particularly the discoveries of the last 5 to 10 years, it is now very doubtful if the theory of evolution will be proved to be a fact as related to the descent of man from animals. That's my position, which is what you wanted. I would need an hour and a half to argue it, but others have heard me do this.
Myself as a Christian speaker, man being a fallen creature is incapable of providing a remedy. That's left to God.
If I could just answer also the previous speaker first, and then, because I would also like to make a comment here, and that is that while I disagree on the scientific evidence with Reverend Pawson, that in fact I would certainly subscribe to the evolutionary theory, I do not believe that we can settle arguments about belief either way on the evidence of natural science in any aspect. To answer your question, or rather your statement, to make a rejoinder to your statement, I would say that I think is the fundamental difference between us, and while I'm sitting here and not there, that I do believe in the fundamental dignity of man and the fundamental ability of man to better himself. Can I say that this is a belief that it is difficult to hold in this world?
Well, I think on that point we'll perhaps move on a little further, because otherwise we may broaden off into things which will prevent us getting a balanced coverage, so to speak. The next point that I wanted to put to the speakers, and I'll ask Mr. Paulson to kick off on this, is what effect his beliefs have on his way of life, or should have on his way of life.
Which question are you going to press? Quite basically, my faith provides me with a point of reference for the three areas of my personality and personal existence: the intellectual area, the emotional area, and the moral area. And I find that my faith provides the compass point, or the magnetic north, which enables these three parts of my personality to find some kind of course by which I can work out how I discover truth and what is truth, how I discover the meaning of my emotions, my fears, my loneliness, my joys, and above all, the need of my life to have some kind of standard by which to live, some kind of guideline as to what I should do, what I shouldn't, other than simply what I think I want to do, or what I think is best for me or for someone else. It provides me with this objective point of reference for all three areas. That's personally. Secondly, my belief gives me very definitely a solid foundation for my attitudes to other people and my relationships with them, beginning with my relationship to my wife and my children. I find again a point of reference in my faith for how our family life should be conducted, widening out to my community, to my world. Above all, it enables me to live with God and with a person who understands me better than I understand myself, and is willing to tell me what I don't like to hear about myself, and willing to stand by me when I'm passing through those moments when you really need help other than your own, and even beyond what other people can supply. That's the kind of difference it has made to me.
Yes.
Well, it is often said that a humanist cannot have an ethic by which to live because he has no belief, and that therefore inherently he is bound to judge things by self-interest. This, I think, is manifestly unfair. It is also said that to the extent that a humanist has a Christian ethic, and humanists often are told that, well, to all intents and purposes they are Christians, to which humanists might imply that some Christians to all intents and purposes are humanists, that to the extent that their moral life, their ethic, appears to be indistinguishable from the Christian, this is because they've been brought up in a Christian country, probably by Christian parents, that at most they may be one or two generations removed from believing Christians, and that as the distance increases, the moral fiber will fail. Now, this last statement is extremely difficult to argue about, because there are, of course, few humanists who do not are not able to sort of go back a couple of generations and find themselves amongst their grandparents or great-grandparents amongst believers. I believe that there are some 8 or 9 generations of rabbis in behind me somewhere. Nevertheless, looking again at the world, one cannot help feeling that there is a considerable discrepancy between what is normally known as the Christian ethic and the way of the world. So possibly the influence on a person's ethic does come more from himself, whether he is a Christian or a humanist. My own belief in the dignity of the individual is what I hope guides my actions. Obviously, it doesn't always. And obviously, there are individuals around in whose dignity I find it difficult to believe. Well, we all fall short of our ideals. But this particular tenet is, in fact, a very good guideline indeed. And it does prevent one from doing all sorts of things that in one's selfish little ways one might. It also, I think, because oneself is also included amongst those that in whose dignity one believes, enable one to have a feeling of pride in what one does well. What one does not have, of course, is the strength that comes from a belief that goes beyond oneself. You referred to that. I have not got it. There are clearly times when it would be nice to think, when one is very much in the slough of despair, that one wasn't dependent entirely on oneself and on those who believe in one's dignity.
Thank you. Now, one topic which I think is very much under pressure and about which people are thinking a lot at the present time is the concept in our society of the family unit. And I would like to ask, first of all, Lewis Elson and then David Paulson, what their views would be of the family unit in society.
Well, I would say that the family unit in society, I'm happy about. If you had said the family unit, full stop, I would not. Because I do not believe you can dissociate the family unit from the society in which it exists. In other words, I do not believe that there is something intrinsically good about a particular pattern of the family unit. There have been many widely different patterns evolved by different societies. I am particularly skeptical about the one that we have evolved, which is known in a rather unhappy term as the nuclear family, consisting essentially of father, mother, one son, one daughter, and a cow. I think our family unit has got too small, and this is not an advocacy of vast numbers of children. It is an advocacy of that I believe that those family units which extended over three generations and extended within each generation over cousins as well in many ways had a security that came from the close relationships that we lack. We can't go back to it. We are a rootless, urbanized society. If we are to save ourselves from our present troubles, we must develop a new kind of family unit, which at present I cannot see.
The Bible recognizes a number of units of people. It recognizes the whole world as one unit, that God made all nations of one blood, which is a revolutionary concept and very relevant to today's politics. It recognizes nations, recognizes tribes, but undoubtedly the basic unit of people in Christian belief is the family. Whether it's made up exactly as has been defined or is rather larger, but essentially made up of parents, two parents, one male, one female, and children. And that this is the basic unit. For two reasons I'm going to give you, one from the Bible and one from psychology. The biblical reason why this is the basic unit is that this is the unit which reflects the relationships that existed in God before there ever was a world or a human race. The Bible puts it like this, that God is the Father after whom every family on earth is named or patterned, which means that there's something profoundly related to ultimate reality in parenthood within the family unit. I could expand that, but I think there's something very profoundly related to ultimate reality here. And that those brought up within a biblical patterned family are most likely to understand an ultimate reality, for their experience in early years will have been most parallel to that which they'll get as adults if they get to know God. The psychological reason why I believe the family unit is fundamental to society is precisely this. A large part of my life is spent counseling people with problems. And you would be astonished how many adult problems can ultimately be traced back to either a lack of or an experience of a distorted pattern of basic family life. And that alone convinces me that the biblical reason has a very great deal to commend it.
Thank you. Well, come round perhaps to the next break. Has anyone questions on these last two points that they would wish to direct?
Professor Elton stated his belief in the dignity of the individual. Has he any biological reason for the evolution of such a point?
You mean, is there some survival value in the dignity of man? In the process of evolution, things that survive are those that, in the struggle for survival, in some sense like that, the dignity of man has survival value. I would have thought that the concept of the dignity of man has not existed for a long enough period on the biological scale for evolution to have had any effect on it. I think this is one of our problems, that the development of man has not been on the biological evolutionary timescale, but on a much more rapid timescale. And that consequently, we are in conflict between our psychological and mental development over the period of maybe the last 50,000 years and the biological backwardness that goes with it, because presumably in the biological evolutionary sense we have remained unchanged over that period, because the biological time scale is of the order of 10 times that, at least. So I really think there's no connection.
There was another question in this area here somewhere.
Sorry, you have to say it again.
I want to know what kind of family life you would propose, which is different from the Christian family life, which is an unselfish love for those around, considering others as well as yourself.
If you state the Christian way of life at its best, it is difficult to improve. Chesterton once said, the trouble with Christianity is not that it was tried and found difficult, but it was found difficult and not tried. Though to the extent that most people fall short of the ideal, I believe that in our present society, the family of father, mother, and quite a small number of children, divorced from the rest of their family, most people are living some considerable distance from their grandparents, from their cousins. That this is what I meant by saying that we have become a rootless society, and that somehow we must find roots again. And this brings me back to the previous questioner, because our social evolution over the last 100 years has been an order of magnitude faster again than our psychological evolution and has left us behind. I don't know any answers.
Thank you. Any more questions, please?
Professor Elton, you say you believe in the dignity of the individual, and from that your humanist beliefs stem. Well, what do you see as being the dignity of the individual? What's an expression of Christian viewpoint?
How do I explain what I mean by the dignity of the individual? That's not an easy one to paraphrase. It's like all beliefs. I'm tempted to tell the parable of the Good Samaritan, possibly. Jesus knew very well why he answered difficult questions in parables. But it is not irrelevant, because it was the answer to the question, and who is my neighbor? And it is that we are all neighbors of each other, that no man is an island to himself, and that comes from a sermon of Dunn's, that really makes me believe that the relationship of ourselves to each other at its best is adequate for me.
Yes?
I'd like to ask Mr. Borson how he sees the distinction between the nuclear Lucas family and the Christian, because we do seem to live in a society of Lucas families.
I find a point of agreement with Professor Elton at this point, that today's families are increasingly isolated units that are too small for real personal relationship. They are not, therefore, Christian families. By a Christian family, I don't mean mother, father, three children, a dog and the common cold, or whatever the definition is. By a Christian family, I mean that kind of group in the rightly ordered relationships with each other and with larger groups outside it, which is part, essentially, of family life. And a Christian would believe that the first relationship that that Christian family will have on a wider scale will be in what is also a family, namely the Church of Christ. And many a Christian family finds in that wider family an essential ground for learning relationships. Again, where the church is a Christian church. For call yourself a family, it doesn't make you a Christian family, and calling yourself a church doesn't make you a Christian church. But where it's rightly ordered in relationships, fine. But the basic one is this. What makes a Christian family is primarily the relationship of that family to God through Christ. And the Good Samaritan parable was told in a context, and the context was a man asking Christ how he ought to live, and Christ said, love God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and then secondly, love your neighbor as yourself. And the man, being something of a humanist, concentrated on the second one.
And Jesus quoted from the Old Testament.
I have three questions that I've seen. I'll take them very briefly, please. One over here first.
Sorry, that's a misunderstanding. I said humanists are often told that this will happen.
I frankly see no evidence for it. But it's difficult to produce conclusive evidence that it's not happening, because there are few humanists who do not, two or three generations back, find themselves with believing grandparents. That's what I said. I did not say that this will happen. On the contrary, I don't believe it.
Well, someone over here, I think, wants to ask a question. Someone here? No? Oh, up to the back then.
Are you speaking about me personally? If the second happened automatically, of course there'd have been no need for Jesus to put that bit in. But it's quite clear that it is possible to learn to love God and not automatically to get right with your neighbor. You are in a much better position to love your neighbor if you love God, because you see your neighbor in quite a different light. You see, for example, his dignity, because God loves him too. And there's nothing better in him or worse than you. But the two are distinct, and Christ gave them as two commandments because they both need to be said. Likewise, it is possible to a degree to love your neighbor without loving God. And I would be the last to state very foolishly that nobody else loves their neighbor but those who love God. But the ideal relationship and the full love involves both.
Yes,
I think I must say at this point, what I'm sure the subject we agree on, that this particular statement first occurs in, I think, Exodus, isn't it?
Well, part of it occurs in Exodus, part in Leviticus.
Right, part in Leviticus. That it has always struck me as an astonishing, the second part, as an astonishing statement at so early a period of the history of a people, namely this humble realization that the prescription of how much one should love one's neighbor is tied to how much one loves oneself. It is not asking too much. It is not asking that I should love the neighbor more than oneself, only that I should love the neighbor as thyself. I think that is reasonable.
Thank you. Well, now, I think we must press on. I have a long question here, which I hope the speakers can do justice to. Mr. Pawson first. Isn't humanism far more satisfying in an intellectual and pragmatic way for a modern, reason-conscious person than a 2,000-year-old religion? Isn't humanism far more satisfying in an intellectual and pragmatic way for a modern, reason-conscious person than a 2,000-year-old religion?
Well, the first thing one must say is that we live in an age when, because a thing is new, it's supposed to be better. I think a thing is good because it's true, not because it's new. And that would be my prior question. The snag with accepting something as better because it's new is that it will most certainly go out of fashion and become old quite quickly. So that's the first thing. I don't know if it's as morally and intellectually and pragmatically satisfying to the humanist as my faith is to me. I know that my faith is profoundly satisfying to me, partly because it's not 2,000 years old. It's very much older than that, for a start. And secondly, because it's very much more contemporary than that question makes it sound. Because of believing and indeed knowing from practical experience that Jesus Christ is alive today, then it ceases to be a belief in a person of 2,000 years ago. So that the question, I'm almost tempted to say, it's another of these, why does a mouse when it spins? And of course the answer to that one is, the more you run, the faster.
Lewis?
Well, I think that question is one on which we can so completely agree in our answers. Humanism is not a recent invention which is in agreement with this scientific age, God help us. Sorry, I shouldn't say that.
Thank you.
in many forms has existed as long as men have thought. You find certainly, I mean, if you read the ancient Greeks, you find it there. I would say that the question is really quite absurd. If anyone, I mean, the most exciting book certainly that I have read for quite a long time, apart from this one, is that one. That's the telling book. So I really think if we are going to judge or be judged on that kind of level, I think we all ought to go home.
Well, let's move on then. Lewis, what is your attitude, please, to the possibility of life beyond the present one?
Well, you remember what I said on the question of what is human destiny. Obviously, life beyond the present one also, in some sense, comes for me into the same category. The word life, to us here, has definite meaning because it's a definite experience. We know what we mean by saying that a person is alive, that an animal is alive. There, that means alive is the opposite of dead. Life is what we are experiencing today. The life beyond death is something of which we totally, absolutely, and completely lack experience. And therefore, the one thing that can be reasonably certain is that if there is such a thing, it will be so utterly and totally and completely different from anything that we can imagine that it would be pointless to link it to our present experience. If I may just tell you I hope harmless story of the person who died and found himself in the presence of the Almighty and somehow or other managed to get back on earth again. And so first thing somebody asked him and discovered that was, well, what's God like? And he said, well, to start with, she's black. It takes a bit longer perhaps to sink in some. What I'm trying to say here is we have preconceptions. And one of our preconceptions is that God in some sense is male. But male is an attribute that belongs to us here. And these are things which in no sense can be transferred so totally beyond our experience. So I have no opinion to life beyond death, and I do not believe that anything that is supposed to have been seen, heard, or experienced through extrasensory perception gives us a worthwhile clue, even if it should be genuine, of which I have no proof.
Thank you.
Well, a Christian believes in life after death because of sensory perception. This is the heart of the evidence for which we believe that we do survive death as conscious selves, rather, individuals. That my personality survives this disintegration of whatever I am inside and the body which I leave behind here. Now, because I'm a Christian, I believe that Christ told the truth. And he said a very great deal about life after death. He certainly believed that he would survive, and he spoke of survival with a body, which relates the life after death very much to the experience of my life here, because life here is also in a body with hands and feet and so on. Now, he said all this kind of thing, but he offered perhaps the greatest proof of all to those he said it to by saying, I will come back after death. And this he did if we are to accept the historical evidence for the resurrection, which is as strong as one could ask for any historical event. And it's significant that when he came back, he said, I am not a ghost. Handle me and see. Look, it's me. Come and shake my hand. Which certainly relates life after death to me and my life here. So while I have no personal experience of life beyond death as yet, Jesus Christ certainly has, And he did come back and prove that he was alive and in a body beyond death. Now that's enough for me as the start. There are a whole lot of other things that are told me in the Bible about life after death. But clearly here is survival of an individual, self-conscious personality with a body. And that's certainly something I can understand and get hold of. But one of the interesting things Jesus once said was this. That even if someone came back from the dead and spoke to others, they still wouldn't believe. And this is precisely what has happened. For he certainly came back, and still people don't believe.
Thank you. Well, now we've reached really the end of the time that I suggested for this kind of examination of questions, in the with the idea of not inviting either speaker to score points off the other, but merely to balance up, so to speak, any aspect that he may feel has been unexplored. I would invite both of them, one at a time, that is to say, to ask the other their opinion on any topic of their choosing. I have warned them of this, so they have had time to think about it in a general sense. Perhaps I could change the order as you've just been talking and ask Professor Elton if he wishes to put anything.
I'm awfully sorry. It's perfectly true you warned me, but you also said that we were to forget everything you had told us on that occasion and come fresh to this meeting.
True.
And I obeyed implicitly. I quite honestly had not given this matter a thought. Could I ask David whether perhaps he was less abyss than me and did give the matter a thought, in which case he could ask me a question first? Help me then.
I think the question I'd love to ask you is about someone from your own nation, as to what you really think about the person of Jesus and what he claimed to be himself.
Yeah. Well, you'll have noticed that all my literary references and quotations were from the Bible and from Christian writers. This is partly due to the fact that there certainly is a great deal more, but also that, in fact, I am very much more knowledgeable about Christian and the Jewish religion than about humanism. This arises from the fact that one learns when one is young and one experiences when one is a little older. That I learned most of the things where I used quotations and so on probably before I was 20, 25, and I've sort of worked with them since. And obviously, one of the things one works with is the phenomenon of Jesus. I'm glad that this Bible is bound all in one volume, because I believe there is a remarkable continuity in the Bible, which to a very large extent is the history of the Jewish people, of their trials and tribulations, of their proud kings and their scathing prophets. And Jesus, to my mind, was in the direct line of these great and scathing prophets that told their people in terms in which it would be difficult, if not impossible, to find in the history of any other people how evil at times they and their rulers were. To me, he is a great teacher, a great prophet, and I hope I have learned something from him. Now I suppose I've got to ask my question.
If you wish.
Well, yes, I would like to ask how far you think that amongst the various beliefs within Christianity, and after all, they were very varied in many ways, and amongst the various religious beliefs outside Christianity, there are many other religions, and among non-believers, whether you feel that there is really any, what one might say, objective evidence for the outsider that points the way to a humanist who is looking for a life as it is to be led. Can he, in fact, now not ask what people believe, but see what people do and find differences?
Yes, I think that this is possible, but not in the sense of undeniable proof.
Oh, no.
No. It's quite clear that the events on which our faith is based happened 2,000 years ago. And the validity of those events and the facts of history on which our faith is based need to be tested by the same kind of historical criteria that would test anything. You're asking for indications today. I think this would involve a personal exposure on the part of a seeking humanist to real Christians who know Jesus Christ personally. I agree with you that there is a great variety of Christians and beliefs and so on under the name of Christianity, but to me Christianity is Christ, and a real Christian is someone who knows Christ, not someone who's perfect, but someone who knows Christ and who is able to show that they do have someone with them who is helping them, who's changing their life. But you would need a certain exposure to a fellowship, a group of real Christians like that, to be convinced that there was something or someone there for which there was no other explanation. That is, in fact, how I became a Christian. And I lived with, for a certain time, a group of young people who quite clearly, at the end of the time I lived with them, had convinced me that they had something I had not got. And when I asked them to put into words what this something was, they said, it isn't something, it's someone. But I was living long enough with them to realize that this was real. So it involves that kind of exposure, since it's in the realm of personal relationships and love. But I think where you meet a group of people who really love Jesus, who have no idea whatsoever that they're better than anybody else, but have a tremendous idea that Jesus is just the greatest, because they've found out personally, that I think is the situation in which you get the kind of evidence you're asking. And of course the number of people who would be in this position of knowing Christ personally is literally now millions. I think if you really seek and if you really look, you can find a bunch of real Christians in most parts of the world if you look for them. But you notice I'm keeping off the word church. I'm deliberately emphasizing those who believe in Jesus Christ personally. And there is that about their life which can't be explained in terms of what they are themselves. They are such a variety of people, such ordinary people, and yet there is that which is extraordinary about them.
Well, now, I think we've been very well behaved. People have kept very much within what I believe was the spirit of this meeting so far. And now I feel that you should all feel free to attempt to ask, raise, challenge the points that you have been bottling up, and not necessarily keep within the framework of the topics that we have asked our two speakers to discuss.
Question one and then two.
Sorry, could you speak a little louder?
In your opening quote, it seemed to me that you said that under God,
now. But surely we're slaves to our passion now. If I may quote Dr. Lazarus, he says he can talk to people and he can tell them that the reason that they're frustrated or anxious or upset is because they're jealous of their neighbor. So then we want his other four. But he can't change it. He can't change their jealousy. They remain jealous. Surely we're slaves to that sort of passion and things like that. How do we overcome that as humans?
Well, you're really begging a question here. I entirely agree with you in when you say that we can be, and possibly often are, slaves to our passions and our baser desires. I always say that nobody who's had children can fail to believe in original sin. However, nevertheless, I believe that it would be wrong to call the what the Americans call orneriness of the average two-year-old original sin. It is a stage in growing up. And it is possible, I hope, to struggle with those stresses that enslave us from within. And our freedom is in that struggle. What Tillich says here is, if we hand over this struggle to someone outside us, to fight for us and present us with a victory on a plate, then we have lost our humanity. If I should ever come to join one of the religions of this world, it would probably be Zoroastrianism, which grew in ancient Persia, and which had the belief that there was a power for good and a power for evil in this world, which were eternally at war, and each one of us was able to add his little bit on the one side or the other, and no one would know which side would win.
Do you have any comments?
Yes, this seems to me, from the Christian point of view, the impossible dilemma. The greatest problem I have is me. History seems to shout at me that the only problem that man can't solve is the problem of man. And therefore, I'm shut up to this possibility. If self is the real problem, how can there be the remedy in myself? This is where the Christian faith seems to me the only possible solution. That if man is the big problem, then he must find a remedy outside himself. This does not destroy his humanity, but one thing is quite certain, it destroys his pride. And I know of no remedy for man's condition that doesn't deal radically with his pride and leave him with him nothing to be proud about at all. Now, if our pride is our humanity, then it destroys his humanity at all as well. But in fact, I find it is just the opposite, that when man is humble enough to ask God to help him, he discovers a humanity that he never had before. It's a paradox. It would seem that you lose your humanity. In fact, you find it. What is humanity? The Christian believes that humanity is to be truly what man was meant to be. And man was meant to love God. And when God has helped you, you love him. So you are, in fact, for the first time, truly human. And you have discovered your humanity.
Okay. There's a second question.
I'd like to ask Professor Elton why he goes as far as saying that Jesus Christ was a prophet, and why he brought forth and finds him the witness of the Bible and of Joseph Secrets in Jewish
I've read Josephus' Jewish War, I've not read anything else of Josephus. Certainly in the Jewish War there is some reference, as far as I remember, to the gospel events. I really would rather not be drawn into a discussion of the interpretation of the events, of historical events described in the Gospels. I did say that I found the teaching of Jesus immense and often immensely helpful. I just don't happen to find the interpretation of the historical events in the same light. I'm sorry.
One of Christ's greatest teachings was that the man should come back to God, and he should have his sins forgiven, and this was shown with Mary Magdalene, and Mary, the woman at the well, and the plea from the cross with Christ. Why can you not accept this? Because really Christ was a great teacher. And what is stopping you accepting it? And I'd also like Mr. Paulson, if he wasn't good afterwards, to say why you can't accept it.
Yeah. Well, start with, in that question that's explicit, the other question was implicit, that one must accept everything or nothing. That's not so. I sincerely hope, however small a teacher I am, that anyone who listens to me will make his own judgments as to what he accepts and what he does not accept. And I must feel free to do so, even with the greatest of teachers. I was specifically referring to the many things that Jesus said about the life one should live. The statement about the forgiveness of sins is one that it is difficult to understand when one tries to translate it into actions as observed by another person. And it's as, maybe this is because I'm a scientist and I tend to look at things from the outside, that I look at it that way and find the statements that you quoted there difficult, if not impossible, to interpret in my frame of reference. Sorry.
My basic problem here is that interwoven in the teaching of Jesus in an inextricable way is first of all a constant assumption that there is a God and that life must be lived related to God. But even more critical is this constant thread which runs right through all his teaching, that he in fact claimed to be God. Now, a man who does that is either mad, bad, or God. You've only three alternatives. And when one studies the life of Jesus, you cannot decide he was mad. Even those who haven't become Christians find it very difficult to make that one stick. Nor can they find it easy to say that he was deliberately deceiving others and that he was bad, which shuts you up to the third possibility. And there can be little doubt when you study the records that the one reason why he was put to death was precisely that he claimed to be God. Behind all the other charges, this was the reason, which makes the cross a pretty crucial question mark about his whole claim, and one which he said would either be confirmed or contradicted by what happened afterwards. But I find it very difficult to unravel the teaching of Jesus and extract a way of life without the existence of God and his claim to be God. And the whole thing strikes me as so utterly integrated and intelligent that I have to accept the lot.
I caught your eye just now.
I was going to ask Professor Elton what he thought of the claims of Jesus to be God. We've come to this point.
Well, really, that's a it's not a fair question almost to ask me after David has just claimed that there are only three possible. ways of interpreting this claim, since I manifestly reject the only respectable one, I would be forced into mad or bad, and I'm not prepared to do either. I do not believe that this is so. I believe that one must judge the scriptures against the society and the history of the time. That this was so different from our own that only a quite profound study can allow us to understand what Jesus could have meant by that statement. But what it does seem to me to be reasonably certain is that it must have been enormously different from what anyone in this room today means by that statement. It's a common error to assume that words have a definite meaning. They don't. Words change their meaning over the centuries, quite apart from the fact that probably even if we use the same words today, you and I and you between yourselves will often find it very difficult to agree on the meaning of words. But if you go back over 2,000 years, the difficulties of interpretation of words and sentences is immense. And as I say, only a real immersion in the history of the time could answer so detailed and specific a question as you asked. What little I know about, for instance, the Essenes that produced the Dead Sea Scrolls and so on, makes me believe that this particular claim was not unique at the time. To that extent, it may not have meant exactly what we think it may mean today, but I would not like to say, I'm sorry, it's not a subject on which I have any real knowledge.
Professor Elton, I wonder if you could enlarge on the your understanding of the dignity of man for yourself, which obviously gives you a great idealism in your own life and will allow you to adopt moral conduct under all circumstances, we hope.
All right. And that's, I'm glad you added that, yes.
But what I'm more concerned about is the humanist philosophy that man is making progress even at this stage at the end of the 20th century. Though your ideals may be adequate for you, what about the other people who are perhaps lacking motivation to do good? What do you see as the progress of man?
I don't think you can accuse me of having made a single statement tonight that indicates that I believe in the progress of mankind. I have expressed myself, I believe, fairly pessimistically about this veil of tears in its present state. I am not an optimist for the future of the human race. Little that has happened in the last 25 years would make me be so. I believe you could only be an optimist if you do have a religious belief.
Thank you.
For the sake of getting perhaps the point a little clearer, is there anyone here who would take a humanist viewpoint more optimistic than that of Professor Elton, who would like to answer the last question? Right,
thank you.
There's an offer, I believe, from the back.
No, it's a question. No, a question.
But could I possibly just say one, not to leave this in complete pessimism. I at the same time do believe that the potentiality for growth to better is there. But this is, as I said earlier to a speaker, there is this constant struggle, in my opinion. And at present, the bad side's winning.
Thank you. Now, before I take another question, I feel a lot of the questions have been coming from the part of the House that is obviously convinced of the Christian point of view. I would like only people who wish to question the Christian point of view to have an opportunity of speaking. So if there's anyone who wishes to pose a question from that direction, they have the floor at the moment. Yes?
I'd rather like to ask the Reverend Paul, why he thinks Christianity has more rights than any other religion, in fact, more correctness than any other religion. In other words, why should it be more credible, we say, than Mohammed, where again there was a prophet, but a different era?
Yes. One of the first basic differences is, of course, that Christianity is one of what we call the historical religions. And its book, it shares this with Judaism, its book is therefore a book of history. It's a book based on events and facts. This makes a marked contrast between the Bible and other books. I don't know if you've read the Quran, for example, but if you go through that, you've got a series of ideas, philosophies, opinions, expressions of thought, but no history, no basic fact on which you can latch or which you can investigate historically, but a claim to be a revelation to a man's mind. So that we have got something much more factual to build on with both Judaism and Christianity. The second great difference, of course, is that Christianity is the only religion in the world still to have its founder alive, or that is the belief of its adherents. It is therefore not a system, but a relationship. Now that makes it again quite different from other religions. It's not a system of thought or a system of life. It is a relationship to the person who founded it. I don't know of any other religion that claims that, and that again puts it in a category quite distinct. A number of people were discussing in India recently, representatives of all the world religions, what each religion had that the others hadn't. And finally they came round to the Christian and they said, now what has Christianity got to offer us that no other religion has? And the Christian thought for a moment and then said, forgiveness. I have lived overseas, I've spoken to those who follow other religions, and I know that that's a profound summary. And that, I believe, is the one remedy needed for the basic problem of human nature. And for these and many other reasons, I think Christianity deserves to be seriously considered. But the simple fact is that Christ, who is the founder and still the leader of Christianity, claimed to be the exclusive way to get to know God personally. And I mean to know him personally, not to believe in him, or to worship him, or to pray, but to know him. And he made that claim. All my knowledge of other religions and those who practice them leads me to believe that his claim is justified.
Could I ask you, that's Christianity, recent religion, only 2,000 years. What about all the people who lived before? How are they going to get to know more about it?
Well, of course, here is where we go to the Old Testament. You see, Christianity is a religion that didn't start, in a sense, with Christ. That's why our Bible goes way back before that. In fact, goes back to the beginning of the world and beyond. For Christ existed before he was born, as well as after he was dead. And therefore, that makes him the contemporary right the way through. And we find that people in the before Christ were related to the God whom he made more fully clear and more fully known. Does that begin to answer your question?
Well, it doesn't really, because Christianity is a religion born 2,000 years ago. All the other people, the Jews, obviously not Christian, and they had Jehovah, who was an entirely different God, and was an entirely different God. For one thing, it was one God instead of three. And that's only for about 800 years or so before Jesus Christ, and all the other people had different factors.
Now, this could develop into a lecture, and it mustn't. You see, Jesus was a Jew, and the Jewish God was the father of Jesus.
Yes, but there is a tiny bit of the world. I mean,
well, now you're branching out beyond the Jews.
Yeah, no, what I'm trying to say, the Jews didn't populate the entire world, not there, anyway.
Yeah.
That's tiny.
They were you leave me breathless with all this. I'm not evading the question when I say this is God's problem and not mine. He made those people. He knows how to deal with them. He has his plans. If you're worried as to how he will judge them, then the Bible makes it quite clear, and the New Testament makes it quite clear, that God judges a man according to the light he has received, which is only fair and just, and God is fair and just. And therefore, if the Aztecs or the Mexicans or the Chinese or whoever have not heard of Christ, God will not judge them for not hearing of Christ, but he will judge them for the light they have already received through their conscience, through the creation he made. And he holds them responsible for living up to what they knew to be right. But where is the human being who can stand before God and say, I have always done what I knew to be right? This is where the need comes in. And Christ came to remedy that need that had arisen in those previous ages. And it was quite obvious that it was a universal need, because no human being had in fact solved this problem of self. And a perverted will that finds it easier to be rude than courteous, and easier to be deceitful than truthful, and easier to say no than yes, or at least my kids all were all like this. So that this is God's problem, and he will deal with it.
We've got about 5 minutes, I think, before I should call this session to a close, and I remove all my inhibitions, so there's a question coming from up there.
How do you reconcile the idea of the absoluteness of God and the responsibility of the individual? Because it's quite meaningless to talk about God as being somebody who is absolute and omnipotent in any way. Of personal responsibility. Do you understand the question? You can't talk about man being responsible for his actions if there's an absolute God.
But I can and I do. No, you see, I think it's illogical to you, because you've defined absolute in a different way from the way in which I would. God is absolutely loving to me, and that absolute must include the giving of freedom to persons. Otherwise, he's not absolute love.
That doesn't sound like ethic, that sounds like freedom.
What do you mean by God is absolute?
It means nothing to me, but as far as any God is a concept which is at all viewable, it must be absolute.
By absolute, do you mean? Do you mean by absolute a God who exercises his power to the exclusion of the freedom of all other wills? Is that what you mean? Well, then this is where I do not believe that God is like that. We can't say what we think God must be and then say God must be that. You see, if there is a God, he is like himself. He's not like what we think he is. We must discover what he is in fact like. And the most profound statement in the Bible about God is love, which removes the kind of thinking that you have expressed in calling him absolute. Because if you love someone, you must respect them as a person. And if you are love, then you give them freedom to hate you if they choose to do so.
So
Professor Elton wants to...
I'd just like to add a word to that. It seems to me this question shows again the difficulty of using words beyond what, in fact, we have any experience of. I know what absolute alcohol is, what absolute means in this context, and so do you probably. But word absolute as applied to God, clearly, as David so rightly said, needs reinterpretation. Your definition of absolute clearly implied the ancient controversy between predestination and free will. If God is absolute, he must know everything, he must know what's going to happen next, therefore everything that we do is already predestined. This controversy has raged at least since the 4th century without becoming more fruitful in the last 1600 years, and I'm sure we shan't solve it tonight. So...
Professor Elton, are there any things in which you believe are realities which you don't experience? So.
No, probably at this late hour, whoever wants a quick answer, clearly he's looking at his watch. I ought to say no, that I do take my beliefs essentially from observation. But I would have to look very much more deeply at myself. Strangely, that particular question I haven't looked at for quite a long time, and whether I could find that really I have beliefs, and I think probably if I do I will find it, for which I could not find observations to which to tie them. I'm inclined to believe, inclined to think, that I do hold such beliefs, but I would have to check rather more carefully than I have time at the moment.
One last question, right?
If the dignity of the land is something which is arrived at, which I think perhaps you suggested, as a result of his sum total of his experience, could you help us to see whether that is likely to be varied as a result of man's environment and with the passage of time and with the distortion of man's nature? Is dignity a standard?
No, certainly not. Dignity can be destroyed, for instance, dreadfully destroyed, as we have learned to find out what happens in concentration camps and under torture. It is not constant in the individual. I don't think it is constant over periods of time, because this to me really goes that man is a social animal. He is in society. He changes within the society. Society changes. You cannot divorce him from society. And to that extent, I don't believe there's anything that is one could describe as absolutely constant in any of us.
Have you any final comment? Well, at this point, I think I hand back to our host president to...